Welcome back to Too Much Future, episode 21. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
This is the show where we play all the Fallout games and we talk about them. This is our second episode of Fallout 3. Last episode, we, I was going to say went to the vault, but we didn't go to the vault. We came out of the vault.
Mm-hmm.
Did all kinds of stuff, Tunnel Snake's Rule. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that episode, Michael, I believe that I said I saw the blinding light of the outdoor world,
mm-hmm.
Where you know where the general room is so big I can't even see the ceiling, and then I cut it off. You didn't do that though. You didn't go outside yet. So why don't you tell me what happened when you went outside, when Eleanor went outside and experienced the Capital Wasteland?
Well, the first thing Eleanor was allowed to do was, as she reached out and touched the door, a voice spoke in her head and said, "Hey, you know all of that life and history that you've just had? Was that accurate?" And as we discussed last time, I had, in creating my character, not realized I could deduct from the pre-rolled stats that they gave me, so I took a moment to redo that and have a character sort of, I guess, maybe more interesting or specialized. So Eleanor was like, "Oh yeah, no, my stats are different. The stats that I chose when I was literally a toddler." She now has a strength of 3, perception of 6, endurance of 4, charisma of 8, intelligence of 6, agility of 8, and luck of 5. So we'll see how this works out. I decided she was going to be kind of weak, and she then that sort of settled in her mind. She opens the door, blinding light, and then as your eyes adjust, and also as everything in the distance gets drawn, you get something that is actually pretty cool, right? Which is that you see the skyline of Washington, D.C., right? The ruined skyline in the distance. You see, like, the dome of the Capitol building and the Washington Monument, and then you see just this brown ruined expanse between you and this very distant horizon, which is honestly, like, that it's a pretty cool visual. I liked that. It's got a nice effect to it, even now, I think.
Yeah, I think I think we're gonna talk about this quite a bit, but I think more works about this game than the general opinion would suggest. But yeah, you see that, and I think important here, brown.
Mm-hmm.
This is from the brown era of video gaming.
Yes,
like everything is a shade of rock, dirt, brownness, kind of living in a rucksack universe, as it were. And importantly too, it's got to look like it could exist on the Xbox 360 and PS3,
yes.
Right? So there's a kind of I don't know. It doesn't look like PC games from the time period, I guess is what I'm trying to say. There is a kind of almost a stylisticness to this game, mm-hmm. that I don't know, just has a real Xbox 360 aesthetic. I would call this the Xbox 360 aesthetic in a general sense, although I don't really know what I mean by that. But but I think you get the vibe, right? Like, you know, it kind of looks like Call of Duty Modern Warfare 4, Call of Duty 4,
yeah.
Modern Warfare, you know, dirt shooters.
Yeah, the dirt shooter is what it looks like. And I don't know, you can wander around the dirt for a little bit. One of the first things that happens is you get messages on your Pip-Boy that's like, "Hey, you can listen to radio." So, of course, I pulled up my Pip-Boy and I listened to the propaganda radio station being put out by the Enclave and got to listen to Malcolm McDowell have just a grand old time playing the president, John Henry Eden, who wants to have a chat with us. Did you listen to the radio?
I didn't listen to the radio. Just because I was very, very goal-oriented, because I was having to play this kind of on a compressed schedule. So mm-hmm. I didn't really listen to the radio any, but I did walk down the path there in front and encountered an Enclave iBot running around, which is playing this radio station
mm-hmm.
to everyone. So I did hear some of this. What did you learn about that?
Well, it's great because it addresses one of the problems that we had in the previous game with the Enclave, which is that you didn't really know anything about the Enclave until the very end of the game. So here at the start, President Eden is here to tell us about how he's like his first sort of, and then I like redid this a couple times to see if like this was scripted to be the first one you hear in it. I'm pretty sure it is. He's like, you know, let's talk about government, shall we, or something like that. And then he basically goes on and he talks about how, you know, you if you're listening to this, did you know that you're American? That this place that you're in is America? That the Enclave is the American government? That I am American and so are you? And it's propaganda, right? It's there to sort of raise awareness in the wasteland of the Enclave and curry favor with the population. And it's a nice little bit of like environmental storytelling, right? It delivers exposition and also like gives you a sense of how this, well, even the fact, for instance, that you saw an iBot, and I actually saw the iBot too, right? Cause I wandered down into the same, it's like a little ruined suburb or something called Springvale. The older Fallout games were very loath to show you pre-war or advanced technology this early.
Yeah, because there's something about the way that those games treat, I don't know, like technology as pacing to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because as you encounter, I guess it's because like a lot of the ways the game systems are interacting with one another, the closer you get to old war technology or old world technology, laser weapons, things like that, power armor, the closer you get to that, the higher level enemies you're going to be facing, because the way you're going to encounter those things is mostly through enemies that you're facing. And so you can't see it too early because those things would just kill you. So there's a way that like, because the world is flat in Fallout 1 and 2, that you could find anything at any given moment. And like encounters are based around what is equivalent to you at any given time, I guess, or in the area of the world that you're in. It's all to say that I think that because of its kind of simulation-y kind of vibe of like do anything, player mm-hmm. choice, whatever, that just really delimits the context in which you can see other technology. Whereas in the case of this iBot, it's just floating around. It has nothing to do with me. It's not going to attack me. It's just this little PR robot. And so I can like be like, whoa, what the hell is that thing? And then like not fight it or mm-hmm. not be attacked by it or whatever. And Fallout 2 did this, right, with the crashed vertibird. But that's it true, wasn't yeah. like in the middle of a zone. You didn't even see that, right?
No, Fallout I didn't. 2.
So, you know, there's a little bit more of a normalization, I think, here. I think it's normalization that's afforded by maybe some, you know, what we were talking about last time of the designers and developers of this game being pretty picky and choosy about what they wanted to take from Fallout 1 and 2. And it seems like pretty clearly one of them is a connection to the old world.
Mm-hmm. Much, much more, right? Because this game, and so this is the next thing I did as Eleanor, is you so much of this game is spent wandering through the ruins of the old world,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we've moved to the open world Bethesda style of game, suddenly the world map is not this kind of weird abstraction where we're moving literally like colored triangles around on a grid. The world is there and we move through it. And so in the previous games, when you saw things from the old world, quote unquote, most of the time it was like, oh, you got, you know, stopped for combat and there's like part of a ruined building in the map where you're fighting all of these praying mantises or whatever. But there's not much to that building. There's not much to be thought about. It's just, it's to show that there was a building here at one point and it's collapsed. And then you would see in settlements buildings that had been mostly preserved that people were now living and working in. But here, like, the first thing you can do as you're walking down from the vault is just go through the ruins of this desolated suburb, where there are some houses still standing, and most of the time it's just, like, ruins of houses, right? We're moving through kind of the remains of the old world in a way that we didn't in the first games, just by dint of, like, those games being top-down or isometric RPGs.
Yeah, I mean, those games had... the world didn't have to be filled in because you basically, in your mind, you filled it in with like everything is destroyed except for these small areas that we go to.
Yes.
You know, everything is annihilated. And what Fallout 3 suggests and the, you know, the kind of idea it's based on is like, well, no, not really. You know, that, there's a lot of destruction. There's a lot of like building in the ruins, but a lot of things would stay, you know, preserved or if not preserved, then at least still stay standing. So that is all to say that it feels like to me that Fallout 3 is a little bit more engaged with the reality of nuclear war than Fallout 1 and 2 were, which for them it was, you know, just kind of this conceptual phantasm, right? Like nuclear war is an excuse to wipe away everything. It's not really a thing.
Well, and like, so the fact, the place where we're heading is the nearest settlement to the vault, which is a city called Megaton, a little settlement, and there's an undetonated nuclear warhead in the direct center of this city, which is built out of, like, airplane scrap in a crater, and this is quite literally the most direct way that the gameplay of this series has acknowledged nuclear weapons at all.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. We think about, oh, yeah, no, Fallout, nuclear war is bad. This is really the first time that nukes have been a thing that existed in the world rather than just kind of a pretense, a thing that you sort of checked off in your mind, like, okay, there was a nuclear war, and now I'm going to do some other stuff. That was kind of the order of the day in the first two games.
Yeah, I can't think of anything in the first two games where anyone even mentioned, like, having, for example, a pre-war nuclear weapon, you know, and thinking about using it or something like that, which you would imagine would be, I don't know, a thing that would be available to you as a designer, you know, mm-hmm. that would be a narrative possibility in your pocket, but maybe not. Maybe you don't want to go there because it's a little bit too easy. But yeah, so there's a big undetonated nuclear weapon, some people, the children of the atom in the bottom mm-hmm. of Megaton, they worship it. And the first thing that happens, I walked through Springvale too, same as you did, but if you take the road into Springvale, you see a bunch of big signs that say Megaton, like hand-painted signs. And so, you know, you head your way on in there. There's a robot out front.
Mm-hmm. Again, howdy. Right? Pre-war technology is here and functional and present in a way that it wasn't in the other game. So again, we're getting that change in the setting.
100%. Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad you're pointing that out. Yeah, just the idea that the pre-war wasteland has a lot of pre-war in it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, things weren't wiped away. And so you go in there and you see all the stuff, and then you meet, is his name Lucas Sims?
Yes. Our new Lucas Killian Sims. Darkwater.
He is the most Killian Darkwater ass Killian Darkwater on the planet. But he's a pretty cool guy. I'm not mad about him.
No, he was nice to me. I don't know if that is how it normally happens or if it's because I had good karma, but he was very, very friendly with me. And he was also the exposition NPC. He's the one who tells you where everything is. Like, here's our clinic. If you want supplies, go to Crater Side Supply, where Moira is. And he also tells us about our... if you ask him about... Because you have the option to say, like, I'm looking for a middle-aged man or something. You're looking for your father. If for some reason you've never played Fallout 3 and you didn't watch the previous episode, we are looking for our father. And he tells you, like, you know, I don't have time, I haven't been keeping track of this, you should go talk to Moriarty, as he pronounces it constantly. But yeah, Moriarty, who is the owner of the local saloon.
Have you met Lucas Sims's kid yet, by any chance?
Yes, Harden Sims.
He's cool.
It's so funny because he's like, he's wearing like the miniature version of his father's little duster, like,
yeah, He's cool. So basically, Lucas Sims is giving us, you know, like, here are the tentpole people to go and see. And right after I talked to him, I talked to, I'm trying to find his name, Nathan? Did you talk to Nathan?
Yes, Nathan. Nathan, the guy who has, like, swallowed the Enclave Kool-Aid.
Yeah, it's a guy who is like an older man who is apparently just, like, listening to the Enclave iBots and Enclave Radio all day long, and he'll just monologue to you about, like, how good the Enclave is, and he's like, I'm an American. I'm an American patriot.
Mm-hmm. And again, right, this is sort of more pointed satire and sort of, like, political and social satire from this game, right? Like, it's hard not to understand this as kind of a commentary on, like, what was at the time, right, 2008's conservative media ecosystem, which has only gotten worse. But it brings that to mind, right? It has that same sort of resonance that I think brings it toward the satirical, right?
And, well, so he even has a bark, right, that is directly from a satire. Barks are just, you know, singular lines of dialogue that characters kind of spout off to give them personality or character or whatever. And when you walk by all the characters in Fallout 3, when you walk by them, or if you, like, mouse over them, so you know, your cursor goes over them, a lot of characters have little pithy phrases they say. So, you know, some of the megaton people that live there, they'll be like, how you doing, partner? What you looking for? That kind of thing. Consequently, aside from this, have you noticed that we've gone from what they were called peasants originally in Fallout 1?
Yes.
We've gone from peasant to settler.
Yes, the non-named NPCs called settlers. Another interesting choice.
It is an interesting choice, but the reason I bring this up is that one of the ones, Nathan, all the characters with names have, you know, I don't know, maybe five or six different things they say, and he says one of the ones he says is "God bless America" and nowhere else, which is, I believe, is what the, and this is like some early 2000s brain. I'm like going all the way back. I'm carrying my way all the way back. And I'm 90% sure this is the phrase from the Chris Rock film Head of State, in which Chris Rock runs for president. And his opponent in that film, his catchphrase, this like arch Republican kind of stereotype, right? His phrase is "God bless America" and nowhere else. So it's not just a satire; it's like a referential satire to another piece of, like, contemporary media, but I wouldn't say popular media.
Yeah,
even a little bit. But anyway, that's a long way to go to say that thing. But 100%, you're right that this is, to my mind, much more purposeful satire than anything else in Fallout 1 and 2, other than that last little bit of Fallout 2.
Yeah, so what did Tonk get up to here in Megaton?
Well, Tonk went and did the things that he knew he had to do. So he went and he asked Lucas Sims, hey, I'm looking for my dad. And Lucas Sims says, hey, I don't know anything about that, but you can go talk to Moriarty. Once you talk to Moriarty, first I talked to the guy who works at the bar named Gob, or perhaps Job.
Yes, Job. No, I was reading that as Job too. I was like, is this I know that they stepped back from the pop culture stuff, but it was like, oh no, is there going to be an Arrested Development shout out here?
Yeah, I wasn't sure, but yeah, Gob or Job, because I don't think anyone says it.
It is Gob.
Okay, it's Gob. So I go in and he's like banging on the radio, and we're getting a little bit of storytelling going on here. This is going to come back later, but he says that Galaxy News Radio, maybe Nova, a woman who is hanging out there with him, who also works in the bar. Nova says, oh, you know, it's not the radio. The radio's not messed up. It's the Galaxy News Radio radio station. The signal's all messed up because Enclave Radio comes in just fine. I wonder what's going on there. So I go in there, I talk to him a little bit, and I'm like not mean to him. I'm just, you know,
yeah.
I'm just not rude. And he's like, oh my gosh. And that's what all ghouls sound like in this universe. It's like, oh my gosh. Which I think is it's a good choice, I think, to give ghouls kind of a voice flavor, I guess. But he's like, oh, I'm glad you're not being mean to me. so here's a discount, but, and then you can tell me a little bit about my dad. And he said, basically just says, you got to talk to Moriarty. So I talked to Moriarty, and Moriarty is just, he's a saloon owning jerk. He has an Irish accent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you find out about that?
I remember that there is a reason for this. Like, there is an in-universe reason for him to have an Irish accent. But what struck me about it, sort of first and foremost, is that there is, in Klamath, I think, in Fallout 2, one of the guys in the saloon there that you can meet is just, like, straight up a stereotypical Irishman who will, like, tell you stories about fairies and things like that. And this seems like, In a weird way, a strangely affectionate callback to this bizarre moment from Fallout 2 that has no further significance or context. But then also, yeah, did you learn the terrible secret of Moriarty's Irish accent?
I did not.
Oh, okay.
I thought maybe you would have. I did not learn it.
We will be able to, I think, at some point. I remember, like, this is one of those things, like, I happen to remember because it raises some questions about the world, but we'll cover that when we get to that episode.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. And that's a big part of this, too. You know, Fallout 3 being so much more open. You know, basically every NPC in Fallout 1 and 2 is kind of a one-shot NPC. Like, in your first conversation, for 99% of people, you're going to be able to get all the information out of them. You know, there's some kind of world state changes in Fallout 3, and there's, like, context changes that happen that do, to my memory, open up more dialogue. So we'll learn about that more later. But he basically says, oh, yeah, look, I know where your dad is. Hey, guess what? You're the little kid grown up now. And I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And he says, well, yeah, I mean, you and your dad showed up here like 20 years ago. He doesn't say exactly. Yeah, but
it's like your dad, his Brotherhood of Steel friend and a little baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, Brotherhood of Steel friend. But yeah, so he reveals to you in kind of roundabout way that you were not born in the vault.
Yeah.
You were, anytime I say anything like that, I just think about Ricky from Trailer Park Boys and saying the word borned. Like, babies get borned. I'm cursed with that. But yeah, he says, like, look, you know, your dad brought you here and you stayed at the saloon and then you went and got in the vault. And, you know, I didn't see him for years and years and years. And now I just saw him the other day and I'm seeing you now. So what gives? And he doesn't really have any more context for you other than the fact that happened. But it has revealed to us that opening scene when you are a baby being born for the very first time, that's not happening in the vault like we thought.
Yeah.
Which is cool, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, it turns out, you know, we weren't born in Candlekeep.
Oh my gosh. I thought we were.
Yeah. Yeah. Turns out we have a greater destiny.
Oh, do we have a brother? perhaps several dozen brothers and sisters who need to Highlander us to death? But yeah, so he gives us that little bit of information. And so, like you just said, gives us a little bit of some hints too, like Brotherhood of Steel. What's going on with them? What are they doing over here? We already hear Enclave, so we're getting all these little pieces of pre-existing stuff. He also basically says he says a couple things about the Vault 101 that are interesting. One, that everyone who's in a vault is brainwashed.
Yep.
Which is interesting. All about the Hail the Overseer and stuff like that. And we remember some of that from last episode. The other one is that people seem to leave that vault pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
He says that someone left the vault 5 years ago. Moira, when we talked to her, she says that someone left 10 or 12 years ago. So it seems like there's a, you know, a fairly robust set of people running out of that thing. I'm surprised we don't know that. You know, since we know everyone who lives in the vault.
Right. Yeah, you think we would notice some of the disappearances.
Yeah, but anyway, all to say, he says, look, I'll tell you where your dad is. I have a commodity. Information is a commodity. I'll sell it to you. I'll tell you where your dad is for 100 caps. And I said, I don't have any money. And he said, well, you can do something for me. He says, a woman, a drug addict, ripped me off. And she's hiding down in Springvale, that place that we walked through. And if you go down and get my money back from her, then I will, then you can take that money and then give me my 100 caps out of the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, all right, fine. So I went off to do that. Did you do this mission?
I did not do this. I completed this in a different way. So you can continue on and I'll tell you what I did after.
Yeah, I just went down to Springvale, found some raiders fighting that iBot, and I think they won, and then I slashed them to death with a knife mm-hmm. that I took from Butch, and go into the only place you can go into. There's only one house with like an interior space in Springvale. She's there, and I talk to her, and I'm just like, look, she tells a different story. You know, it's this kind of classic, you know, Bethesda storytelling here. One person tells you one thing, another person tells you another thing. You got to make some decisions in the middle about who you trust and who you believe. Mm-hmm. She basically says, look, she was employed by Moriarty to, I forget exactly how she phrases it, but to like entertain the men at the saloon. And she was tired of doing it and it sucked and she didn't want to do it anymore. And so she said she was leaving and Moriarty said yes. And then he said no the next day, and so she just ran away. So she took her money and ran off, and she just wants to be free of Moriarty. And so I said, okay, well, look, I don't know. I don't care one way or the other really here. Why don't you just give me some of your money, and then I'll go back and I'll say you're dead, and that, you know, here's the money that came from it. And she said, okay, you know, he's made up all this stuff about me. He says I'm a drug addict, all this stuff. It's all fake, blah, blah, blah. So she gives me 300 caps. I immediately walk into the next room, which is her bedroom, and there's drugs everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's like Psycho and Jet and all kinds of stuff. So it's interesting, you know, where it's, again, kind of classic Bethesda stuff of like, who knows who's telling the truth, you know, but I have made my choice in the middle, which is like, I got some money and I'm going to take it back and I'm going to tell her that he is dead. I do that. And then he tells me, where my dad is, or the next direction my dad has gone, which is Rivet City, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, like the GNC Plaza or whatever that means.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, you're 100% right. It's not Rivet City. That's from another thing that I talked to. Yeah, that he is going to the Galaxy News Radio Plaza that we heard about already, and we don't know why.
Right. Yep. So how this worked out for Eleanor is when you are talking to Moriarty about... like when he drops the bomb, so to speak, of you not being born in the vault, you can, your dialogue options are like kind of to protest, to be like, no, you're lying, like this isn't true, my dad wouldn't have lied to me, all this sort of stuff, and you can you can protest against what Moriarty is telling you, and he gets progressively sort of more like irritated with you for not believing him. And then finally, one of the last sort of dialogue options in this tree is to lie and say, actually, my dad talked about you all the time. So many great memories. You guys were good friends. And
oh, really?
Yes. And so this is what Eleanor told him. And then he was like, oh, is that so? Well, I'll tell you where your dad went. For free.
Huh. Yeah, so it's already pretty clear that there are going to be a lot of speech options that I just don't have access to.
Yeah.
Although I have had access already to a couple of dialogue options that were just strength, and I could click on them and it would be like, oh, I'm going to threaten to beat you up or whatever, which really isn't Tonk's vibe, but, you know, maybe in the future.
Maybe. Maybe for the right person. Oh, and I should say, I leveled up when I came out of the vault. And I got, you get perks every level now in Fallout 3, which is nice because I always felt like in the first two games that you never got to play with as many perks as you would want to. But I chose, I don't remember what my perk was, intense training, which means I get 10% more experience per level because I'm going to power level. This is how I do Bethesda games.
Get big and strong.
Mm-hmm. Well, big and swift, I guess, for Eleanor. A couple of other things I did here, actually, just incidentally, I did talk to Lucas Sims about the bomb in the center of town, and he said that I could try to disarm it if I wanted to, but no one really cared. So that's an outstanding quest here.
The power of the atom.
Mm-hmm.
I have that too. I have also leveled up over the course of this entire recording session. I leveled up, I think, 3 times. I think maybe I'm level 5 or level 3 now, or level 4.
It is. So this is very Bethesda. The level cap in this game at launch was 20. And here in the first area, we are a quarter of the way through that because I'm also level 5.
Yeah, my memory of it is that it slows down a whole lot.
Yeah.
Like in the middle teens, but probably it might not because of the addition of the DLC. I don't remember exactly, but
Just incidentally, did you do you have the DLC packs activated?
I don't think I do because to my memory, and you tell me if I'm wrong, if you have them activated when you launch the game, it like gives you all of the quests to start them all at one time. And that didn't happen to me, so I might need to like do something to activate them.
Yeah, so that is true. I have them activated, and what happens is like the second you step out of the vault, your radio just starts. This is actually kind of the ingenious little use of the radio, is that they use it to introduce the DLCs, because all the DLCs they come onto your radar precisely because you pick up some stray radio signal. Mm-hmm. So you step out of the vault and, you know, you level up. And then as I'm walking down the street, it's just popping up and it's like, and the other thing that's very funny is that the DLCs load in reverse order. So you get like the last DLC, which is Mothership Zeta, which is the wacky one where you find an alien ship and fight aliens and things like that. And so like you walk out of the vault and the first thing that happens is you receive an alien distress signal. And the little pop-up tells you this, right? The pop-up is like, mm-hmm. you have received some strange da-da-da-da-da, and then, you know, you get all of these others, and they're all set up as, you receive a radio signal of a specific character from a specific place. Shall you follow it and find out the source? And then you get the first DLC, the first Fallout 3 DLC, which is Broken Steel, and it just pops up and it says, the Broken Steel content pack is now loaded. The level cap has been changed to 30. So you see in this like weird set, like looking at sediment or like strata in layers of rock, right? You see Bethesda go from, we don't know how, or you see them like introducing DLC all the way back to, we don't know what to do with DLC. You installed it. Good job.
you've done it. but yeah, I've leveled up several times here, and but here's the thing. Because you have certain stats, you're able to choose different perks, right? Because each perk has like a level minimum and like a stat minimum
yes.
in order to choose it. I don't meet any of the requirements for most of them. And so I can only choose from like 4 all the way up to whatever level I am, level 4 or 5.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I have now taken 3 separate parts of or levels of I think it's called Bat Boy, which is melee weapons and explosives, and like that's just what I can do. So I'm very strong at doing those things at this point. But
I've taken mostly
no lot of variety.
I was gonna say I've taken a couple of things in intense training. I think I might have taken one that gave me a small guns boost, and I also took one called Black Widow that allows me to have unique dialogue options with male NPCs.
Yeah, oh, I can check that one, too. It's called Lady Killer, if you're a man.
Ah.
Which is Black Widow, kind of an interesting trope in cinema history. Lady Killer, just a murderer.
Yeah.
not a lot of interesting reference or trope there. But yeah, so we did that quest. There are a couple other quests that, like, get introduced here. You tell me which one you want to talk about. I didn't do this quest yet, but this is an outstanding one we have to address at some point. Mr. Burke tried to talk to me, and I'm just, you know, putting a little pin in that for people. We're not doing this quest yet. This is the Tenpenny Tower quest. We will address that at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. I got a quest from Lucy West.
Yes.
To take a message to her family in Erifu. Mm-hmm. And also got a quest from Moira to work on the Wasteland Survival Guide. Which of these would you like to talk about, Michael?
Well, let's actually do Erifu first, because I have more interesting things to say about Wasteland Survival Guide.
Okay. Tell me about what happened. So Lucy West says, hey, my family lives out in Erifu. I need someone to deliver letters to them. And I said, why can't you go do that yourself? And she says, it's really dangerous. She says they call it the Capital Wasteland for a reason. And so basically it's just, hey, be a little mail carrier. Mm-hmm. And hop to it. So that's what I did. I traveled across the wastes. How'd you get there?
I also traveled across the wastes. I walked all the way to Arifu, which is kind of annoying to get to because it is a settlement on the remains of an overpass.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get to Arifu, but you're actually under it. You have to keep walking to get to the part where you can walk up to it. But I walked all the way over there, and I fought some raiders and some, like, lots of dogs, lots of mole rats. It was mostly uneventful.
Did you find a Mirelurk yet?
I have not fought Mirelurks. Well, I have seen Mirelurks, but I have not fought them.
Gotcha. So you got to Arifu, and then what happened?
You get up there, there's a guy who shoots at you. His name is Evan King, and he's like this old guy who's like, I thought you were someone else. And he explains that this tiny little settlement called Arifu, which I think is called Arifu because there's, as you're walking up the overpass, there's an old traffic sign that's been like damaged or defaced. And I think it's used to say careful, but the beginning and end of it has been worn away. So it just says Arifu. So you go up there and he's like, oh gosh, I thought you were, you know, one of the family. And you're like, what's the family? And he's like, well, they're this gang that is hanging around and causing trouble. And they started out just doing, you know, normal gang stuff. They would break things and do vandalism, but then they killed all of our Brahmin. And now everyone in this town, there's like three little families. Everyone in this town is kind of on lockdown. Because they're also scared of the family showing up. And Evan King tells you, well, you can tell him, like, well, I have a letter here for Ian West, who is Lucy's younger brother. And he's like, well, go talk to him, right? That's between you and them. And you can check in on the people in the town. There's one couple where the wife is like, and I'm using a loaded term here, but like, this is clearly how the game wants you to take it, right? The wife is crazy, because she talks about the world around her not as if it's a post-apocalyptic wasteland and she lives in a tin shack, but she talks about it as if it were like still sort of the 1950s suburbia, because she's talking about how pretty the lawns are and how she's baking cookies and so on and so forth. So that's interesting. That's there. There's also a woman who lives by herself, who I don't remember saying anything particularly interesting, but you can talk to them about like Arifu and about the family, and it's all stuff basically that you could guess, right? That the family is a gang and people don't like them and they're doing weird things. They're coming around at night. Eventually you get into the West home, which is at the very back of the settlement, and you go in and there's just two corpses in there. The Wests are dead, but Ian, the younger brother, is not there. And you can, Eleanor could inspect the corpses and find out basically nothing useful because she doesn't have a high enough medicine skill or whatever.
Yeah, but the game is so Tom couldn't figure anything about that either, but he could look at the corpse and it would be like, you don't have a high enough medicine skill to do that. But this is an interesting kind of like skill check, basically. I mean, you know, it's a, mm-hmm. it's almost as if, you know, if this were Fallout 2, you could click the little skill thing over on the side and then click on the corpse to see if you could learn something about it. I thought that was an interesting kind of like conceptual connection to the past of the game or the past of the franchise. And I don't know how often that kind of thing happens through the rest of the game. I don't remember it being very common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you find that out, and you go back and you tell Evan King, and he's like, ah, dang, the family did this. And then he tasks you with checking into it, and he tells you, well, we don't really know where they live. So he gives you one of three places nearby. It's like an old drive-in theater, a former like transit station, and something else. I don't remember what the third one is, but there are three places.
It's called like Something's Hideout. And it's literally just like a hole tunneled in some rock that ends up going into like this catacomb of industrial space. It's really weird. It's like a straight up Oblivion dungeon. Like that's the only way to describe it.
Yeah. I mean, another thing that sort of struck me on a meta level playing this game was just how much Oblivion and Skyrim is in here.
Yeah.
Just the feeling of that. But anyway, so you can go check these places out. Only one of them is correct. I lucked out and went to the one that was, to me, the closest, and it was the one that was correct. It was the transit station. Mm-hmm. And there I met another ghoul named Murphy, who told me he's like trying to manufacture a ultra jet.
Are you here for my secrets?
Yes.
How to make ultra jet.
And he you can ask him, like, I'm just looking for this gang. Can you help me? And he's like, oh, there are some tunnels in the back, but hey, while you're here, I'm trying to create super meth. It takes three ingredients. Just in case you were wondering, it takes three ingredients to make super meth. I have the other two, but it's hard for me to get my hands on the third one. If you can bring me sugar bombs, I will pay you. Sugar bombs being a type of, like, I think breakfast cereal that you can scavenge from the ruins.
I told him I didn't want to make super meth. I told him I was not interested in helping him create a jet that was so good even a corpse could use it, because that's the whole thing, is that normal jet doesn't work on a ghoul, and so he wants to make ultra jet so that even ghouls can get high. And I thought that was a bad idea.
He has a sewer grate in the back of his offices, and if you go down through here, this is where Eleanor encountered some Mire Lurks, because you end up in these radioactive tunnels, and there are Mire Lurks hanging out here, and this is a new enemy type, did not appear in Fallout 1 and 2. They are giant mutated crab people, and they are... I mean, for Eleanor, they are really, really hard, like murderously hard, because they're just big armored melee types, and that is not at all how Eleanor rolls in terms of her combat. So how I got through this, I had actually done some of the Wasteland Survival Guide quests before this, and in one of those, I had picked up some stealth boys. So I just applied a stealth boy, went invisible, and walked past all the Mire Lurks until I emerged into an abandoned train depot where the family has hidden out. How did this turn out for Tonk?
Well, so the Mire Lurks are particularly bad because, like, in a general sense, if you are just a normal character playing the game, you can shoot them in the face, like right in the face, and that will hurt them and, like, will crit them. And so, like, that, you know, that's the way that in the future... Eleanor will, like, figure out how to do it. But you can't hit things in the face as a melee character. Like, Vats doesn't work that way. I don't think that... Maybe manually doing it would work, but... So like, even the strategy, the best strategy you can have against Mire Lurks doesn't really work for Tonk. So he just ran by them, and when they melee you, there's, like, a 40% chance, it seems like, for them to immediately break one of your limbs. Just with a big snipping claw. So it's particularly rough. So I ran by them. And then I thought, you know what? I'm really good at explosives. And I'm good at grenades. And so I came back and blew them up with a grenade. just to get the experience points. And, you know, because I thought, oh, maybe I got to come back this way. So I might as well do it. You ultimately don't have to come back this way. But I didn't know that. And so I did that. Destroyed them, and then ran on in, and basically, you know, there's a guard out front, and the guard says, what's your business here? And I was like, well, I have a letter to deliver to a child. Is he here?
No, he said,
oh, yeah, you know, he's in there. Go check it out. You need to go talk to Vance, maybe, is the guy's
yes,
name?
Yes, Vance.
Gotta go talk to Vance, and I ended up having a long conversation with Vance. I'm going to summarize that here, if that's okay. I don't think we got to go through the whole
ahead.
Thing. He says, so let me just give you the big tent pole here. Everyone in the family are former cannibals.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the Wasteland, there's just a desire for cannibalism. Like, it just gets you sometime. And so some people are just born cannibals, and you can't do anything about it.
Yep.
That's the implication here. So he says, hey, if you really want to know what we're up to, you need to talk to everyone who lives here, figure out about the rules we have.
This is so weird. This whole thing is so weird.
It is really weird. And I guess the idea is, like, if you don't do something like this, you're just going to come in and talk to that guy and, like, you know, finish this up really quickly. And so you end up talking to, what, five other characters there? And they're pretty
something
cool.
Like
they're
that.
All
yeah.
interesting characters with different backgrounds and lives. And they can tell you about the family. It's a nice little built out, I think, little universe, little, small little universe, if you're interested in this kind of thing. But they give you all these rules. And all the rules are basically like, we don't go out during the daytime. You know, we drink all the blood, blah, blah, blah. And so you talk back to Vance.
We don't have children.
We don't have children. We only bring people in. You know, we get the exiles. And so you talk back to Vance and you're like, he's like, have you figured out what we're all about? And you're like, y'all are a bunch of Draculas. Y'all are a whole bunch of Draculas, damn it. And so they're all vampires. And he basically says, look, here's the deal. We didn't abduct Ian. The truth of the matter is that much like us, Ian was born cannibal. He's got darkness inside of him. And we were trying to help him out. But sadly, before we could get to him, he murdered his whole family and ate them. And that's why they're like so messed up. Their corpses are so messed up. So I've got him here in isolation. I think that maybe you don't need to talk to him. And like that was the end of the conversation. That was very annoying to me. And I was like, So I tried to talk to him again. First dialogue option I have with him. Can I talk to Ian? And he was like, you know what? Yeah, I think so. I think.
Oh, my gosh.
So I don't know what was going on there, but it really went from like a dead end of a conversation to just getting to start over. And I was like, I need to talk to Ian. And he was like, yeah, sure. That sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. No problem. This was slightly different for Eleanor in that when I came back and was when I came back and talked to Vance, I could be like, you're cosplaying vampires, right? It wasn't like you guys are a bunch of Draculas. It was like you guys are pretending to be vampires for some reason, like very incredulous and sort of critical. You can also accuse Vance of like brainwashing these people, which is interesting because it evokes like Moriarty said about the Vaults and the Overseer, right? We're getting a kind of sense of some themes in this game about how ideology gets disseminated and embodied or something. Anyway, the thing that I think needs to be noted about Vance is that his demeanor is very much like a man pretending he is a vampire. And so this entire quest to me feels very much like almost knowing self-parody on Bethesda's part, because it feels like a Dark Brotherhood thing from an Elder Scrolls game, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that one of the opening quests of their Fallout, their vision of Fallout, is what if people were pretending to be fantasy creatures in a Fallout world? But then it does have some of this weird stuff of, like, people are born cannibals, and, like, and there's a darkness in people, so there's a lot going on here that doesn't make a lot of sense. But I ended up going and talking to Ian, and because he's like locked in a room by himself. Ian is maybe 13, 12, 13, 14. He's a child. Has the voice of a 65-year-old man. He talks like this. I'm Ian, and I blah 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 blah. I murdered my family, and I'm sorry about it. It's really weird. It's off-putting. And I'll put it in right here so people can hear it. But you can have a conversation with him, and he's like, look, I murdered my family. My sister doesn't care about me. She ran away, blah, blah, blah. And I said, hey, I've got a letter from your sister to your family. And he reads it, and he says, oh, dang, she was asking about me a whole lot, huh? Maybe I don't have to join this family.
Maybe I don't have to be a vampire.
Yeah, maybe I don't have to commit to being a vampire. And so he does. He went back home, and I talked to Vance, and I was like, hey, this kid's leaving. And Vance said, well, why don't you try to make a deal? You know, a deal with Erefu. And we talked about it a bit, and so the negotiation ended up, Erefu will provide blood packs to them for them to drink blood, of course. And in exchange for the protection of Erefu, who only had that one guy, basically, protecting them. And so now the family will provide protection in kind of a rotating order. And everyone agreed to that. They thought that was hunky-dory, and the quest was over.
Yeah, same. That's actually exactly how this ended for Eleanor. She, I actually didn't have to go back and talk to Vance. I did that just because I wanted to, because I talked to Vance's wife and she gave me the password to the door. Because Eleanor had a high enough charisma that I just had a tagged like speech option. Charisma is just like, hey, can you let me talk to Ian? And she's like, you know what? Sure. Here's the password to his room. So I didn't have to go around and talk to all the other family people. But otherwise, the end result of this was the same. I even negotiated the exact same terms between Arafu and the family. That was that. One thing to note, Lucy West, the person who gives you this quest, is, I would say, 98% sure that this is an intentional reference to Lucy Westenra, who is a character in Stoker's Dracula.
Dang.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Lucy.
Yep.
The one.
Yeah, the Mina's friend who gets turned into a vampire.
Who she's the first one, right?
Yep.
If I remember correctly. But unfortunate thing about Lucy, you go back to Megaton and you talk to her and you like can't tell her any of this information.
Yeah, she does not care.
Yeah, which is unfortunate.
Did you go back to Arafu when Ian got there and talk to him?
No, I didn't talk to him.
So he will give you the story of how he was first confronted with like he and his sister were being harassed by a raider or something, and he just like lost his shit and like ate the raider, like attacked him and chewed out his throat, because of his, you know, the innate tendency toward cannibalism that people I guess are exhibiting now. Yeah, and Lucy watched this and she was like, "It's okay, you had no choice."
Sometimes you gotta eat a guy, yeah. You know. I'm not in the Fallout 3 averse. I did go back and talk to Vance at the very end, though, mm-hmm. and I learned how to be a vampire. Did you do this? Oh, cool.
I did not do this, no.
Yeah, after the whole thing is over, you can go back and talk to Vance, and you can say, hey, Vance, you know, there's a lot going on here that I don't agree with, but the one thing I do think is cool is vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you could teach me a little bit of that? And he said, yeah, well, I can't teach you everything, but I can teach you how to get basically more sustenance from blood. And so you can get 20 hit points from eating a blood pack now, or I got like a perk to do that.
Nice.
Which means they're almost as good as a stim pack.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's pretty good. But then we went back and I actually did these out of order. I went and did, we'll talk about it in just a second, but I did the minefield mission first. Before mm-hmm. doing Arafu. And so I walked from Minefield to Arafu. And let me tell you, there's a lot of enemies in between there, including a bunch of super mutants.
I did not get attacked by them. I saw the red thing on my compass and I hit the VATS targeting to see if I could, you know, pop through and get a sense of the lay of the land. And I saw it was a super mutant and I was like, oh, crap.
Yeah, they're scary. I thought maybe I'd try to fight one. Because they have big melee weapons, you know, have like a big plank mm-hmm. of wood and stuff like that. And the thing just started beating on me. Like I was not ready to do that. And I was already being attacked by like bloat flies and all kinds of other stuff. And so I just ran away.
Yeah.
Running away is a very viable strategy in Fallout 3.
It is.
But Wasteland Survival Guide mission starts with Moira. And she basically mm-hmm. says, hey, I run a supply company in Megaton. Mm-hmm. But I just love the idea of collecting information, kind of a, you know, an encyclopedia, survival guide of how to live in the capital wasteland. And so she has all these research projects she needs help with, and she can't do it because she's working all day long. She's got to put in that 40 hours a week. She's a small business owner, got to do her own mm-hmm. taxes and stuff. She doesn't have mm-hmm. time to go get irradiated. And
H&R Block did not survive the war.
They didn't. That's a huge problem. But here's the thing. There's a gap in the market. And when there's a gap in the market, someone can always fill it. So I don't know. Fallout 3 could go a lot of places. I'm hoping that becoming a CPA is going to be a part of my mission, my journey for Tonk. You know, CPA and melee skills are mm-hmm. closely aligned with one another. But she says, hey, I have three different missions to complete Chapter 1 of the Wasteland Survival Guide. She says, I need someone to go to a grocery store, an abandoned grocery store, to check and see if there's food and medicine, basically to like how to scavenge 101.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I have a mission to go to a place called Minefield so you can discover how mines work and to see like why everyone avoids that area. So a little bit of like exploration stuff. And she has a mission to just get irradiated and figure out what the hell that would be like. And I did them in that order. Is that the order that you did them in?
I did Super Duper Mart, Irradiated, and then Minefield.
Okay. Well, tell us about the Super Duper Mart.
So this is interesting because my experience of the Super Duper Mart reminded me of my first experience with the Super Duper Mart when I first played this game way back in 2008. And this was a very interesting experience because of how when I think about playing Fallout 2 and the parts of that came back to me as I was playing it, none of them came as strongly as going to the Super Duper Mart. Like, and it's not like the Super Duper Mart is a thing that everyone talks about in this game, right? It is literally like basically a tutorial quest. My memories of, for instance, New Reno in Fallout 2 was a lot of just like, here are all these little mechanisms I can poke at and see what happens, right? Like that ended up being kind of the experience of that game for me. And the Super Duper Mart quest, I remember playing for the first time playing Fallout 3. It's all these things come along with it, right? I know it was like the winter holiday break when I was in undergrad, but because this is how I would play games, is I wouldn't play games throughout the semester, and I would sort of collect whatever was coming out, and then I would play them all kind of in a marathon session during the winter break. So it was like probably like, you know, 12:30 in the morning or something. And I remember so distinctly how interesting and like cool it felt to be sneaking up on this old not a convenience store, but a grocery store, and having a post-apocalyptic shootout there, but sort of like taking in kind of what I talked about at the beginning of this episode, right, of actually going through the world that has experienced kind of this nuclear war and societal collapse. And I realized as I was playing the game this time, right, like flashing back to myself and remembering what I was thinking and thinking about how interesting it was that I was playing a game set like with this particular part set in a grocery store. And it was like, I know what a grocery store is, right? There's something familiar about there are some like raiders out front and you fight through them and then you get inside. And there's like, you know, cash registers, there's old checkouts, there's all of these mostly empty shelves that have been partially destroyed, and some raiders inside are standing on top of them. And they've like made like kind of a little circuit that they have so they can keep watch of people coming in and out. And I was remembering like mapping what I was seeing against things that I have seen or experienced in real life, right? My actual real life experiences of grocery stores. And I realized this time, like, oh, I became my own thesis. Where back during Fallout 2, I said one of the things that was really, like, what I think was really special about Fallout 2 in its time was the willingness with which it was, the willingness it had to get close to its players' like social reality. And I was like, oh, this is this happening in a different way, right? By like allowing me to go into this grocery store and look at all of the ruins and the junk, because there's so much crap here that is completely useless, tin cans and so on and so forth. It was like a weird moment of having that entire memory come back and realize like, oh, this was a point where I was really enjoying this game. I don't know. So do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I have maybe not the exact same thing, but I think that a word you didn't use, but I think it is appropriate here, is I think that this mission is iconic. And I think that this is iconic because it is designed to bring a lot of different systems together at one time, where and to exploit them or to like put them in your face. Whereas most missions in Fallout, most quests in Fallout 3 are not. You know, mm-hmm. most quests in Fallout 3 you can approach through in a different way, but I wouldn't say that they are all designed in order to make the, all of those approaches feel interesting. You know, for the most part, you're just wandering down tunnels and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what is fascinating about this, and I agree, I have, you know, very strong memories of playing this game for the first time and doing this mission, because, right, you go into the grocery store, you can immediately see a whole bunch of things. It's very dark compared mm-hmm. to how bright it is outside, you know, when the sun is up in the wasteland. It's dark. You can see people standing on top of the shelves and walking mm-hmm. back and forth on these planks, and they can't see you when you're doing it. There are grocery carts everywhere. You're right. There's tin cans everywhere. There's like a couple smaller rooms off to the side. And so immediately you have like this like push for stealth. It feels like you should be doing stealth here. Mm-hmm. But then when you start doing stealth, it activates all these other systems in the game. So, for example, if you are sneaking around in Fallout 3 and you run into an object, it makes noise and NPCs will hear that noise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it like it lures you into like, oh, shit, I need to like use the stealth system. I'm not playing a stealthy character, but even I did some stealth here. Because I don't know how many enemies are here. I don't know how dangerous this is going to be. And then immediately puts you into a situation in which those systems are going to fail and mm-hmm. things run into one another. It's even better kind of, I think, across the whole thing. So the way that I did this mission is the way that I, you know, the fastest way of doing it. I didn't have much health. I just fought a giant ant right outside. and so I was kind of hurting. And so I went in and made an immediate right and like looted everything in a small little storage room and then just left. I didn't do stuff. But I know, because I've done this several times, if you, there's an optional objective here of getting medicine.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get the medicine, you got to go to the back room. If you go to the back room and you loot the medicine, presumably you're going to have to kill everyone who's in there. And after you loot the medicine and you're trying to leave, some raiders who were out on a raiding mission come back and you have to like deal with them as well. So it's even like a multi-stage encounter, mm-hmm. which as far as I know, there aren't any others like that in Fallout 3. It really has a strong kind of tutorialization, I don't know, vibe to it that just isn't anywhere else in this game that I can think of off the top of my head. And certainly if those things are in the rest of this game, it is not iconic in the way that this mission is. It also has a skull in a toilet.
Yes, it does.
So you know that it's good.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor stealthed around a little bit. I did complete the optional objective. The thing that I thought was interesting about stealth this time is I was thinking back to Fallout 2. When I was doing stealth in Fallout 2, the reward for playing a stealthy character was getting to avoid combat. Mm-hmm. Like, straight up, like, that is what you did stealth for, so you did not have to fight things. What is interesting about stealth in this game, as you said, like, stealth is in some ways designed to fail. And in that way, like, stealth here is a prelude to combat. Like, what you want to do in Fallout 3 when you're in stealth is you want to shoot someone who doesn't know you're there and get your like cool critical shot, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have to start fighting other people. So I think that's also an interesting change, how stealth is not a way of avoiding combat. It is a mode of approaching combat.
Yeah, it's a way to get an edge on things, yes. Which is and also and I think that's for good reasons, because also Fallout 1 and 2, it was a way of avoiding combat. The reward was avoiding combat, and the reward was also just not getting an experience for anything.
Also that, yeah.
And that's bad. Mm-hmm. That didn't make for a good gameplay experience necessarily. So in funneling you toward, unfortunately, it's funneling us toward combat a lot of the time still in Fallout 3, but at least in funneling us toward that and giving us a new approach, we still get experience. We still get, you know, quest completion in a similar kind of way.
Yeah. So I went through, found the key, like I went to the back room, found the key to the pharmacy, got the medicine out of the pharmacy. Another little interesting system in the back is that there's a Protectron security robot that if you have a high enough science skill, you can hack. And presumably when the second wave of raiders comes in, as you already mentioned, you can start up that Protectron and send it out, and it will fight the raiders for you while you make your escape. I didn't have the right skills to do that, so I just fought more raiders and then left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was there all of maybe 4 minutes.
Yeah. I also just want to point out very quickly that I think it's interesting how the raiders have changed in this game. Because the other thing that the thing that we haven't mentioned, right, is that there are like corpses strung up around this place, mm-hmm. to suggest that the raiders are cannibals, because everyone is you know, everyone's a cannibal in waiting in Fallout 3, I guess. But I think this is worth pointing out, because one thing that was interesting about Fallout 1 and Fallout 2, and we saw this even in the Fallout Bible with some of the stuff that was cut. The raider factions were civilizations, right? Were cultures. They did have beliefs and sort of command structures, and they were not, like, by Fallout 2, right, raiders, as they call them, are basically just groups of mercenaries. But they're not sort of, they're not, like, inhuman, like, cannibal scavengers like they are here. And this is, I mean, There's some stuff to be said about it, and we can probably say some more about it later, but it's a very Bethesda thing. If you think of, like, Skyrim and how it treats the Falmer, right? Like, we need a population of enemies, basically humanoid enemies, that we can kill without any sort of remorse. And so we have this bizarre, like, constantly replenishing population of just very grotesque cannibal raiders.
Yeah, it's kind of like the triple down of Mad Max. I think there's a lot of discussion that I remember when this game came out about the kind of jettisoning some of the aesthetics from Fallout 1 and 2 around raiders in particular, where they just kind of wore the same clothes as everyone else, and mm-hmm. then injecting kind of a Mad Max leather aesthetic, which is absolutely true. But what's interesting about it is that in all of the Mad Max-iverse, as it were, raiders or whatever are always like part of a population. You know, they have a base, they live somewhere, they're aligned with some leader, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Here they are just from, you know, they emanate from the natural world.
Yeah.
They show up from with their, you know, leather harness straps on, their master blaster armor or whatever. And then they do their thing, and then they like recede into the wasteland. And sometimes they do have locations. There's an overpass kind of near Megaton where, like, you know, that's a raider camp and things like that. So it's not to say that that's entirely absent, but you're 100% right. I mean, they, for all intents and purposes, are just like bears, you know?
Yeah.
or whatever.
Goblins.
They're goblins. That is very, very apt, right? They are goblins or Atronachs or whatever that exist to summon up to give you a challenge at some points and then to disappear in other ways. Which, compared to other things in this game, which we'll talk to eventually, or we'll talk about in later episodes, it doesn't really hold true to the rest of the world. I mean, there are super mutants here, but they are clustered around particular places, and there are other factions that we'll meet. I don't want to give anything away, but there are other factions that we'll see that are clustered around particular kinds of things. And so it is weird that raiders are treated as unnatural in the sense that they are people doing bad stuff. But they are treated as natural and that they are just part of the wasteland. I think we're going to have a whole lot more to say about that. I think if there was an interplay logic going on in Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 about how the world works, there's absolutely a Bethesda logic to how that works in Fallout 3 and beyond. But we'll get there later. So two other quests from Moira here. There's getting irradiated, which just requires you to go stand and get irradiated.
Yep, I just went down to the undetonated bomb and drank a whole bunch of water.
I had already drank a lot of water outdoors, and so I was good to go by the time I got there. And then there's this minefield mission, which I think is, to me, just as iconic as the Super Duper Mart, but for different reasons. She says, basically, hey, there's mines that exist in the Capital Wasteland. There's a place called Minefield that people stay away from because it's covered in mine. Why don't you go see what's going on with that? And I said, okie dokie, I'll go do that.
Mm-hmm.
You get there, and you start seeing mines just on the ground everywhere. They just exist. And so I know, I've played this game a couple times before, I know you can run up to them, and if you click on them quickly enough, you will get to pick them up. You can disarm it, and you get to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
So much easier on PC, by the way, than it ever was on Xbox. you know, my ability to like click very quickly and navigate the cursor over the thing, way easier. But you do that, and she wants you to get to a playground in the middle of the town,
mm-hmm.
this whole suburb-looking thing. And as I'm going up, I'm collecting these mines. I'm looking at the ground. And I start hearing this like ping, ping, mm-hmm. ping around me. And I don't know what it is. And a car to my right explodes and like breaks my arm.
Mm-hmm.
And as I look up when that happens, I see that there is a dude on top of like a ruined tower in front of me, just sniping the shit out of me as I'm looking at the ground, trying not to get exploded. And that to me is like exactly what a 3D Fallout gives you.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's what a 3D Fallout offers that like an isometric Fallout doesn't. It gives you like scale. It gives you height and things like that. It gives you this kind of 3D world that you can navigate. And there's just no way for Fallout 1 and 2 to replicate the kind of feeling that I had when I like looked up into the sky at someone who clearly had a sniper rifle, and I was like, oh shit, I don't know how I'm going to get there without getting shot.
Right. No, that feeling of like, oh shit, I'm being hunted.
Yeah. And right. It's cool. Like, it works. You know, this game came out 10 years ago, and this still works.
Yeah. Eleanor died like 100 million times throughout this entire segment, so much that like the game actually crashed, and I had to restart.
Yeah, I had quite a few crashes. Not in this section, but just kind of across this play session. I had two or three. Mostly trying to go in and out of places. But I eventually ran up to the wall of the location that he was in and sniping me from. And he came down the tower. Oh. And so I hacked him up with, I think, a baseball bat, maybe.
His name is Arkansas, by the way. Because you can, once you're close enough, you can toggle onto him in VATS. And it's just like, it's Arkansas. Somehow Vats knows his name.
Yeah, and he's got something else going on, too. I'm not 100% sure, and I didn't look it up or anything. But I'm curious, because you can, when you kill him, he has a key on his body for mm-hmm. a gate, some sort of gate, and I don't know what that's all about.
So the key on his body opens up all of the houses in the subdivision.
Oh.
Because this is where, and this is similar to, like, going through the abandoned grocery store, right? We can go into these abandoned houses and find the corpses of people still lying in bed, right, as they were lying the morning the bombs fell, and things like that. But this is also where Eleanor found her stealth boys, because I ended up robbing some of these people.
Oh.
I mean, well, they're... I guess I didn't rob them. They are like, they've been dead for like 200 years.
Yeah, it's my stealth boy. You looted them.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my experience was like eventually I worked my way over to the tower where he was. I was like trying to sneak up on him. I did. I took him out. And then I was like, oh, I've got this key. I can go check out some of these houses, I think, that had locks that were the lock skill or whatever was too high. And I hopped off and, of course, hopped right onto another mine and exploded. So that's fun. That's always fun when you have a moment of success and you're like, yeah, this is great. And then you kill yourself accidentally.
Yeah, it's good. That's how you know the game is good.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, went back to Mara and she said, thanks so much for all this information. I gave her mine, of course, out of my mm-hmm. like 20 I have in my thing now.
Right.
And she said, great, that's the end of chapter one. And we haven't said this yet, but when you turn these quests in, you can give her like your on the ground information, because that's how she's writing the book. And at every single turn, I get endurance here as an option. So every single time I'm like, being irradiated isn't anything. Like, it's perfectly fine. Like, I don't feel anything when I'm irradiated. And there's another one, too, that I was able to see about endurance. It might have been the mines thing, where I was like, yeah, it doesn't hurt when the mine blows up on you. and if I remember correctly, that changes the way the Wasteland Survival Guide, like, quest ends, the way that you respond to these questions. But I don't remember exactly how, so I'm curious to see how that functions.
Well, it's like I can, for instance, I don't know if this is available to talk, but like I can lie to her every single time. Like I can just give her false information about what happened. And I am also under the impression that if you spend this entire quest just like lying to her, you make a very bad Wasteland survival guide.
Yes. Exciting. Well, that's all we've done for this episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're on the hunt for our dad, Liam Neeson, still, mm-hmm. and he is somewhere near Galaxy News Radio. However, we're not doing Galaxy News Radio next. There's a lot of side quest content in this game, and so we're trying to kind of mix that in with everything. And if I remember correctly, the Galaxy News Radio portion of the game is actually pretty lengthy. So in the next mission, we're going to be doing some stuff for our next episode, I should say. We should call our episodes missions. but in the next episode, we're going to be doing a couple side quests in the region, and maybe we're going to see what's up with Tenpenny Tower.
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah, let's figure that out. But Michael, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at WarrenIsDead.
You can check out twitter.com/rangetouch to see everything that we're up to. And as of today, this reveals when we're recording, but you'll hear this in like a month probably. But Michael, what has released today?
The first episode of our new podcast, Just King Things, where you and I talk about the books of Stephen King in publication order. The first episode on Carrie launched this morning.
Yes, and people seem to like it. We've gotten some good responses on Twitter and on the Discord. And if you enjoyed this show, there is no reason you would not enjoy that show, I promise you. If you think, but I'm just a Fallout peasant. I'm just a Fallout commoner. I only care about Fallout and thinking about Fallout. I don't care about Stephen King, Steve, Richard Bachman. Who is that? The Randall Flagg, the walking dude? I don't know anything about that. That's perfectly fine. In the same way that you can listen to this show and have a good time, not knowing anything about Fallout, probably, you can listen to Just King Things and have a good time and do it. So we're talking about all the Stephen King works in publication order. It's going to be a fun time. Carrie is a great episode. And we're going to be recording Salem's Lot very soon. I need to start reading that book.
Yeah, you do.
In a couple days. It's a fast read, and I've read it a bunch of times before. That's all to say, you can enjoy that show. Go to rangetouch.com in order to learn more about it. And if you want to support any and everything that we do, you can go to patreon.com in order to do so. We have all kinds of cool exclusive things going on over there. That's not true. I don't know why I said that. But you can get our notes for our other show, Game Study Study Buddies. You can get this show in a podcast form. If you don't want to watch it on YouTube, you can get a podcast feed there. And you can get another podcast that Danny and I put out once a month where we're just going to talk about media stuff. And people seem to enjoy that quite a bit. It's a good old time. I bet you would enjoy it. So if you enjoy the show, if you've listened to all of Too Much Future and you think, dang, I wish there was some cool way to support these shows and this show, come check us $3 a month.
Yeah.
It's not going to hurt you. Probably. Well, Michael, do we have a catchphrase for this show?
War never changes, but Fallout sure does.